Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Seth Maskett, who is the author of the very recent book, Learning from Loss, The Democrats 2016-2020. This is published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. And this is a really fascinating and deep dive in terms of the research and the methods in understanding why narratives are important for political parties in particular. But I will let Seth talk to us about that. I'd like to welcome Seth to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this particular project in the shape that it took.
Thank you so much for having me on, Lily. So this was a book I had an idea for back in 2016. A lot of my work up until now has focused on political parties, usually at the state level. I have prior books on polarization in California and on party reform movements in various states. I wanted to focus a book on a national political party, and I was interested in essentially capturing a party making a decision across a four-year presidential cycle. There's plenty of good books out there that examine the decisions that parties make. What stances to take or who to nominate or what issues to dig in on and what issues to abandon and things like that. But all those books tend to assume that some sort of a conversation takes place within a political party about, say, why they lost the last election or why they won another election and what they need to do for next time. And I wanted to capture that conversation. When I had the idea for this in 2016, I was assuming this was going to be about the Republican Party. That is, they had a really unusual nomination process that year at the presidential level when they came up with Donald Trump, despite him not having almost any elite support within the party and a really weird set of debates and primaries and caucuses. And they seemed to be on the path for a loss at the presidential level. He was trailing to Hillary Clinton by pretty substantial margins. And I just figured, well, after they lose, the Republicans are going to have an interesting moment of self-reflection coming up. Obviously, it didn't pan out that way. And Republicans haven't really had that discussion yet. But Democrats have. And they had another interesting discussion in that they lost a very narrow election and needed to figure out what they were going to do for next time around. So this book was essentially a chance to dig into that. And I spent, I examined different aspects of the Democratic Party, broadly speaking. A lot of the time I focused on Democratic activists in the early contest states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada and South Carolina, as well as a bunch of Democratic activists in DC, trying to get a sense from fairly early on in this period, starting in early 2017, trying to get a sense of why they thought Hillary Clinton lost, and then sort of who they were leaning toward. What is their interpretation of that election leaning them to think about for 2020? I also look at a number of other different facets of the party. I follow a lot of reform efforts as they work their way through the Democratic National Committee, their efforts to reform superdelegates and other things. I look at campaign finance patterns and other patterns. But it ends up being kind of a dissection of how they, you know, how Democrats started with the largest and most diverse field of presidential candidates in history and came up with Joe Biden, an older moderate white guy. It ended up being a pretty fascinating journey.
And I sort of wanted to ask you to start this conversation a little bit with this question that you pose, or the assertion that you make, that if one controls the narrative, you control the future. I'm in the middle right now of teaching Machiavelli's Prince, and it sounded very much like Machiavelli to me when I read that. And yet I study narratives, and I'm really intrigued by how you weave through your analysis the issue of understanding the narrative, particularly in politics. Can you talk a little bit about how this is kind of a framing mechanism for this study?
Yeah, I focused a lot on narratives in this. And thanks for referencing Machiavelli there. I thought, you know, I sound a little bit like a Bond villain when I was writing stuff like that. But I was interested in the idea of how political actors, you know, political activists and others within a party, you know, how they interpret a loss, and then essentially what that leads them to do. And, you know, importantly, I wasn't really interested whether those narratives were true or not. Honestly, it's very hard to decide whether, you know, an interpretation of an election is true or false, particularly when it's a very close one like 2016 was. You know, a lot of ideas have some truth to them. But, you know, I was drawing a lot on Margie Hershey's work, her early work on, you know, specifically looking at like the 1984 presidential election, where, you know, Ronald Reagan obviously beat Walter Mondale by a landslide that year. But then she did an analysis of this where she looked at media narratives after that election. Just look at how, you know, how news, you know, op-eds and news stories describe why Ronald Reagan beat Mondale. And I think there were dozens of different narratives early on, and, you know, when in the week or two following the election, ranging from everything like, you know, Reagan was just a better campaigner, or Mondale was unappealing, or Mondale's pledge to raise taxes, or anything else. And eventually those kind of narrowed down into just a handful of narratives. And I was really curious about that. Obviously, there's been work done on narratives in other contexts before, you know, like Julia Zari's book on mandates is essentially, you know, part of that same literature. But I was particularly interested in the idea of the loss narrative. That is, you know, a political party that wins doesn't necessarily have to rethink a whole lot of things. They just kind of assume that whatever they did last time was the right thing to do. Whereas a party that loses, especially when they didn't expect to lose, is due for some reflection. And the moment they lose, there is an attempt by people within that party to define the purpose for that loss, to define what that meant and what it causes the party to do. And this actually, you know, this ties into Phil Klinkner's book, The Losing Parties, where he digs into parties having conversations after losses at the presidential level from the 1950s through the 1990s, and just sort of, you know, just details what some party leaders were saying about those losses. And it's a very interesting study, and you know, sort of focuses on what those losses kind of lead those parties to do, whether it's to rethink, you know, on the Democratic side, it's often to like rethink how they do nominations or make some other reforms. On the Republican side, it's usually a decision to reallocate some campaign resources to different parts of the country. I wanted to dig in on that at the among Democrats in 2016. And what you really see is in some ways, a similar set of narratives that have emerged every time the Democrats lose over the past 50 or 60 years. That is, that, you know, there's always some group of more conservative leaning Democrats within the party who say, you know, the problem was we were too much in the thrall of the feminists, or we were too much in the thrall of Jesse Jackson, or you know, some version of that argument, suggesting that the party needs to recalibrate with a rightward move. Yeah, this wasn't the only narrative that came out of 2016. There were actually lots of them in competition with each other. And importantly, the party never reached anything like a consensus about 2016. They are still pretty messed up about that and still pretty confused. You know, the collection of narratives have sort of, you know, led them in a specific direction that resulted in Biden's nomination.
And I mean, I do remember back in my somewhat youth that there was a lot of discussion when Ted Kennedy was perpetually running for president. The party of Ted Kennedy wasn't the Democratic Party of everybody else. And that was, you know, again, as you say, it's the sort of the regular understanding that Democrats have of the disconnection between the elites who are running for office and the rest of the party, or who may be the party. But you said that the fact that there is no consensus about 2016 is what makes your research and your dive into sort of the various attempts to suss out people's understanding of 2016 as you know, the heart of the book. And so I wanted to ask you a bit about the different kinds of approaches that you used to get at some of this information. You did experimental studies, you did interviews. It's a multi-method approach, but in sort of not necessarily a traditional political science way.
Yeah, I really did. I wanted to approach this from a number of, you know, different methodological approaches, as well as examining lots of different parts of the party, you know, whether we're talking about activists or donors or DNC members or Democratic voters, frankly. So, you know, I to the extent I can examine a whole party, that was really what I was trying to do here. The thing I probably spent the bulk of my time on with this was the activist interviews. And a lot of the results of that simply came out from just lengthy conversations I had with them, you know, opening with the question, why do you think Hillary Clinton lost? That in itself could be like an hour long answer. People have a lot of opinions about that. People were, honestly, when I was talking with them, they were really wrestling with it and trying to decide, you know, it was for many Democratic activists, a very disorienting election. And they didn't fully understand why it had come out the way it did. And they were, you know, struggling to come up with answers. And so, you know, a lot of that was just, you know, I spent some time just doing content analysis of those interviews, you know, just digging through transcripts of these very lengthy interviews, trying to categorize which of the various narratives people came up with. I ultimately boiled it down to, like, you know, roughly 8 different narratives about Hillary Clinton's loss that included things like the campaign itself was flawed. You know, it was allocating resources in the wrong way, or it was campaigning incorrectly, running bad ads. There were narratives about the messaging. Narratives about Hillary Clinton specifically, that she was a poorer choice for candidate, or that Donald Trump had strengths that they had underappreciated at the time. There was sort of this identity politics narrative, this idea that Democrats spent too much time advocating for underrepresented groups and not enough reaching out to working class whites in swing states. You know, ideas about other candidates like Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein, or, you know, sort of exogenous actors like James Comey or even, you know, Russian interference. And I just tried to categorize things that way. But I also did, I have kind of a content analysis of news coverage as well, you know, looking to try to plug news coverage into the same narratives, to see how many news stories explaining the 2016 election, you know, fall into those narratives. And I find, honestly, a similar pattern among news coverage in that there was a lot of there were a lot of theories that emerged among political reporters shortly after 2016, and they never really converged on a story. I compared that with 2012 and 2008, where, you know, you see a fair number of narratives emerge quickly to explain an election result and then converge very quickly within a couple of weeks or a few months on kind of a just a handful of narratives. And that convergence really didn't happen after 2016. You know, even seasoned political reporters a year later had less of an idea of why 2016 happened than they did just in the weeks after. So yeah, there was that methodological approach. There was, you know, some serious number crunching with donation patterns to examine factionalism within the party. And then there was a survey experiment in there as well. I did with Pavel Haines, who was a postdoctoral scholar in the Center on American Politics that I direct at the University of Denver. And she's now at Rollins College in Florida. But she and I wanted to examine kind of the impact of these post-election narratives on, you know, potentially new voters. So what we did, we designed a survey in which we, you know, we had a large sample of people. Half of them, we showed this what we call the identity politics election narrative about 2016. You know, that as we said, you know, Hillary Clinton spent too much time advocating for underrepresented groups and, you know, not enough to reach out to working class whites. And that's why she lost. You know, half saw that, half didn't. And then we asked people, you know, a series of questions about what type of candidate they might like to see as the Democratic nominee for 2020. You know, this was a group of Democrats. We were asking these questions too. And we found, you know, generally speaking, that those who saw that identity politics narrative became more interested in nominating a white person for president. They became more interested in nominating a man, more interested in nominating a moderate. And that effect was particularly true among white women and among black respondents, both men and women. You know, that is, white men already had tended to prefer a relatively moderate white man. And this, you know, this little narrative didn't really change their views all that much, but it made others in the sample move more in that direction toward wanting to moderate a moderate white guy. You know, so that, you know, we didn't use names in there. We didn't say this means Joe Biden or anything like that. But survey experiments like that, you know, tended to reinforce this other message in the book that, you know, that kind of message, that kind of narrative coming out of 2016, it influenced people. It influenced the Democratic race and made people more likely to nominate someone like Joe Biden.
And I mean, it certainly is a lot of what the discussion is throughout the book in terms of the invisible primary and trying to suss out what is going on among the party actors, as you note, not just elites, but organizers in some of the early states and donors and so forth. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, you're talking about this sort of narrative of the message of 2016 and how that role influence the invisible primary that you say started the day after the election and goes until the first votes are cast in Iowa.
So I think this is where, you know, my book it sort of operates in the shadow of, you know, an important book, The Party Decides, Cohen, Carol, Noel and Zoller's book from 2008. You know, of course, you know, one of the leading books about presidential nominations right now, where, you know, they focus on the decisions that parties make about whom to nominate. And That was definitely a framework I was working within for this book, and curious basically if that, you know, if that theory still held. But you know, the sort of additional wrinkle I was bringing to the table was this idea that a party is not just deciding among candidates, but it's deciding about these narratives, and that the competition for these narratives is actually a very important thing that goes on within a party during a presidential election cycle. Essentially, what a party is trying to do in that long and invisible primary, you know, theoretically from the day after it loses one presidential election to, I guess, to, you know, the Iowa caucuses in the next one, is they're trying to balance, you know, really two sets of things. One is, you know, figuring out what exactly it is they want as a party, you know, in terms of policy, and, you know, related to that, you know, which candidate they think can deliver that for them. And also figure out, you know, what is the lesson of the last election in terms of who can win elections? They're constantly recalibrating. They're constantly trying to figure out how much can, you know, how much of the things that we care about can we get and still get into office? So, you know, we see, you know, historically parties kind of wrestle with this. You know, there was a kind of a familiar lesson in the 1960s and 1970s where you saw, say, you know, the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater in 1964. He loses by a, you know, roughly 20-point landslide. And there's kind of a conversation within the Republican Party in the years after that, you know, with the implication that, wow, we nominated someone too radical for the country. The country wasn't interested in that message. We need to rein our activists in someone if we really want a chance of winning. And then sort of, you know, calculating, we can get a lot of the things we care about with Richard Nixon, but he is seen as a somewhat more moderate candidate. And then they win narrowly with Nixon in 68. Democrats go through a similar process after they nominate George McGovern in 72. They also get wiped out by roughly a 20-point margin, and then recalibrate with Jimmy Carter 4 years later. You know, with the lesson being, if we can rein in our activists somewhat, nominate a more moderate candidate, we can still get a lot of the things we care about, but we get in. You know, we can nominate someone successfully that way. Democrats went through this whole process in the 1980s as well. You know, first losing hugely with Walter Mondale, recalibrating somewhat with Mike Dukakis in 88, but still losing, and then recalibrating further with Bill Clinton in 92 when they get a win. And again, this is, you know, that moderation is not necessarily the reason for the victory, but it is certainly a persuasive framework within the party that is, you know, people tend to believe that that's why they won. And, you know, so they're trying to, you know, always figure out that balance. So coming up with a narrative for why they lost in 2016 is really important for figuring out how they calibrate for 2020. That is, you know, figure out what it is they care about, what it is they still want to fight for, but also, you know, who it is they think can actually get into office. And 2016 really, you know, was very disorienting in that sense. Democrats had nominated, you know, obviously some within the party had been concerned in 2008 when they nominated the first major party black candidate as a party nominee. And, you know, some were concerned that the country might not vote for Barack Obama simply because of the color of his skin. And he won. He won twice, you know, winning, you know, not only the popular vote, but a majority of the popular vote twice, a rare feat. And so they, you know, a lot of Democrats came through that thinking, okay, we've sort of figured this out. The country is ready to be pushed in this direction a little bit. And that, you know, they had the idea that the country would elect Hillary Clinton too, you know, just based on years of polling, based on how she was doing in 2016 and the years prior to that. And then it turned out, you know, the country just didn't vote for her in big enough numbers that she won the Electoral College. And so there was a big fight to understand that. There were some within the party who simply wanted to say, the problem was identity. The country wasn't prepared to either vote for a woman or vote for a feminist or vote specifically for Hillary Clinton. Someone who Fox News and other conservatives had been demonizing for, nearly three decades at that point. But coming up with that answer proved really important for that calculation, for that decision within the party about, understanding just what the electorate would accept and allow them to get into office.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so I wanted to ask you to follow up on that a little bit in terms of the lessons of the last election being one of the narratives that the party wrestles with, particularly when they lose. As you say, when you win, you just say, okay, well, we did that right, so let's mostly do it again. But when you lose, you try to figure out why that loss happened. At the same time, as you note that the ideology of the party is one that may be in tension with some of the narratives around the loss. And in your book, you're sort of threading both of those sort of narratives or frameworks around how the party then gets to Joe Biden as right. the nominee. And so if you could sort of talk about how you see the pieces sorting out, because you also note that while there are some factors about Biden's nomination that seem inevitable, there are lots of others that make it seem not.
Yes. So it's interesting because in the framework of the party decides, a lot of that calibration by a party after an election loss, figuring out, exactly what they care about and exactly, who they think can get in, a lot of that is framed in terms of ideology. The Democrats are deciding they want to be as left as possible and still get into office, essentially. And the conversations that I had with activists in the wake of 2016 didn't necessarily focus on ideology all that much, at least not very explicitly. There were very few people saying, that Hillary Clinton was too far to the left to win, that she had too radical a message and we need to, dramatically rethink, the party's platform in that sense. This ties into somewhat about, what exactly ideology means within the Democratic Party. Thinking somewhat of Grossman and Hopkins' work on the asymmetry between the two parties, where they kind of frame the Republicans as a very ideological organization and Democrats as an organization that's really focused on groups and the placement and competition among those various interest groups. And as I described in this book, I tend to see, the competition among groups as a form of ideology on the Democratic side. That is, Democrats, the main thing that they're interested in is representation, in egalitarianism, and in making sure that lots of different identity groups within the Democratic Party feel welcome, that the ones that are suffering are helped, that, you know, underrepresented groups get represented better. And that's a form of ideology. So as I saw it, you know, one of these narratives coming out of 2016 had to do with identity. It had to do with, you know, in some ways, you know, both, you know, both in terms of gender and in terms of race. It was a very racially conscious election. That, you know, some came out of that election feeling that the party had pushed too far in the direction of identity, that Hillary Clinton had been too explicitly, you know, I mean, part of her lifelong identity is as an advocate for feminist concerns, but also that she was too explicitly advocating for, you know, increased representation for underrepresented groups, people of color, the LGBT community, women, and so forth. And that this was, of course, like essentially like the core mission of the Democratic Party over the last few decades, that they had to rein that in somewhat. That this is the thing that, you know, as essentially the party's core mission, this is the thing they have to sacrifice a bit of in the name of electability. This is the thing that they, you know, they're essentially negotiating with the electorate over. And, you know, that wasn't the, you know, unanimous narrative among the people I spoke to by a long shot. There were a lot of people who thought, actually, you know, maybe the Democratic Party should have been more explicit in trying to champion underrepresented groups, and that the fact that they weren't was a reason that, say, Black turnout was down somewhat in a number of key states in the upper Midwest, or, you know, that some parts of the party were less enthusiastic. But this was a, you know, this sort of identity politics concern was really a pretty persuasive narrative for many in the party. And, you know, one of the arguments I make in there is that if you come away from 2016 thinking that, you know, the problem was the party ran bad ads, or they'd simply nominated the wrong candidate, or, you know, they were devoting resources to the wrong parts of the country, those are fixable. You can change those for the next election without needing to dramatically rethink who you are as a political party. If you come away thinking that, you know, essentially the party's core mission of helping underrepresented groups, you know, of trying to level some of the inequalities in American society, that mission was actually hurting it in elections, that can be a very disorienting message. That you know, that's a very bitter pill to swallow, and that's one that Democrats, you know, a lot of Democrats were really struggling with. And so, you know, in many ways came out of that saying, you know, we need to go with something safe. And overwhelmingly, they saw Joe Biden as a safe candidate, you know, which is, you know, it's an interesting idea. I mean, that's in some ways an identity that he himself has, you know, spent decades cultivating. You know, if you follow Joe Biden's career, he's kind of relentlessly been at the center of the Democratic Party for like nearly 50 years now. I mean, he's sort of very good at figuring out, you know, who's to the left of him and who's to the right of him within the party. You know, never associated with any particular form of radicalism, you know, tries to be pretty affable. He is generally seen as in some ways sort of a safe place that the party could retreat to. I use this, a metaphor in the book of, Hillary Clinton being kind of the new Coke candidate. That is, you know, the party felt like they were trying something innovative with Hillary Clinton. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And when it failed, they really weren't sure why it failed. Some were like, oh, you know, is the flavor bad, or did we market it poorly, or did we misread the market out there? You know, ultimately they decided it wasn't that important to figure out why they went wrong. Let's just get back to Coke Classic as quickly as we can. And Joe Biden was kind of the Coke Classic candidate. He was just sort of a, a version of their product that they felt had done well in the past. And so he was sort of a logical choice in that direction.
And at the same time that you note, he needed to make it through a field that was the largest and most diverse in history.
Yes.
which also reflects the sort of lack of consensus about why New Coke failed.
So I don't know if I wrote it in exactly these terms in the book, but thinking about Biden's nomination is kind of fascinating. You know, when I teach about party nominations in my classes, I tend to teach it in the sense that I think a lot of the media narratives about presidential nominations are wrong, you know, or at least somewhat off, and that they frame it as a contest. That is, presidential candidates all have to do a certain set of tasks. They have to visit all these early contest states. They, have to flip pancakes in New Hampshire and, eat a pork sandwich in Iowa and compete well in debates and give good speeches and come up with good policy stances and things like that. And whoever does most of these things the best will become the nominee. And I that's wrong. And if you want a great example of why that's wrong, look at 2016. I don't think there's any of these tasks that Biden did the best at. You could certainly find lots of other strengths from different candidates. You could see, Bernie Sanders had, I think by far the most enthusiastic set of supporters. Elizabeth Warren could talk about policy far better than anyone else. You had lots of different candidates could do certain things much better. Biden was, less a winner of all these contests than he was a choice. And that is, I think what we need to be seeing party nominations as is it is a decision made by collectively by a party. And he was what they came up with as, someone who could win in the general election. And it's fascinating to sort of watch him over the course of, 2019, when he gets in the race and early 2020, where he never really, in terms of his like actual campaign performances, almost nothing he did was catastrophically bad. Although nothing was really, outstandingly good either. He usually did serviceably well in most of the debates and most of his speeches. And I think his approach was mainly to not get caught up in some of the symbolic ideological battles that a lot of other candidates were. I mean, it was really, if you listen to some of the conversations being had among Democratic candidates and some of the debates in 2019 and early 2020, it's really kind of fascinating. I mean, a lot of those candidates are really competing for, what they saw as the kind of energetic left, who they expected to show up for the caucuses and primaries, and you hear arguments for things like reparations for slavery, Medicare for all, abolishing ICE, and things that I don't think you would have heard at a major party debate just a few years earlier, were all of a sudden, I don't know if they were the mainstream position, but they were being discussed pretty broadly. And Biden largely kind of ducked those fights to the extent he could. He didn't want to take specific, he didn't adopt any of the major left slogans, but, simply suggested he was open to talking about stuff. And he never really closed any doors either. And that ended up being actually, a fairly smart position to take. There were, again, a lot of people who were sort of looking for a safe position to fall back on. They thought he could be that guy. He didn't seem alienating to anyone. There was a lesson that, and this comes through in the book a lot, both a lot of polling studies of Democratic voters in 2019 and 2020, as well as the conversations I was having with activists, all suggested a surprising degree of pragmatism among Democrats. To an unusual degree, Democrats were willing to give up a fair number of things that they believed in in order to get a win. They were really, you know, unusually focused on defeating Donald Trump and getting him out of office. You know, even to the point of nominating a candidate they didn't necessarily agree with on most issues. They were really, you know, unusually focused on what they viewed as electability. And, you know, that's a, you know, a hot buzzword. Obviously, I spend some time dissecting in this book about what exactly it means to consider someone electable and how difficult it is to actually prove any of that. But, you know, when your focus is on electability, you can tend to fall back on some assumptions about what sort of candidates do well and what don't. And, you know, that was the kind of thing that helped Biden's candidacy a great deal, was the fact that the Democrats were willing to give up a lot for what they perceived as the most electable candidate.
And in this way, you also start out the book by noting not only that you initially intended to write this about a different party, but as you note, many people were surprised on election night in 2016, but they were also surprised that Donald Trump got the nomination. And I sort of feel like throughout the book, you are reflecting a little bit of that. Again, it's not about the Republican Party. It's not about Donald Trump's path to the nomination. But also it was a little bit like that happened to them. So what do we do for us?
Yeah, that honestly, you know, Trump's nomination weighs pretty heavily over this book. And, you know, when I first started this, many ways I was sort of wrestling with that, you know, with what that meant for party politics, what that meant for kind of my own understanding for how party nominations work. And in many ways, Trump's nomination in 2016 is the far weirder event than Trump's victory in the general election. You know, there's a lot of things that go into general elections. A lot of things come down to a coin toss in the end. It was, you know, if you sort of buy economic forecast models, it was likely to be a fairly close election to begin with. But he's not the sort of candidate that tends to win a party nomination, right? You know, a lot of rich and famous people think they should be president, but parties generally aren't open to that. And he managed to get through, and that was just an unusual nomination. So I was curious, coming out of 2016, you know, basically, does our understanding of party nominations still hold? The model of the party decides really didn't explain Trump's nomination well at all. You know, that model tends to hold that, you know, people within a party make something of a collective decision about what sort of candidate they want. And then they, you know, steer the party's voters toward that decision in the primaries and caucuses. And that really is not what happened on the Republican side in 2016. Essentially, you know, the party itself just did not make a decision. You know, people who normally endorse candidates largely didn't endorse. To the extent they did, they were kind of split between Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Scott Walker and a few others. And they just mostly sat back and let the voters pick. So, and on the Democratic side in 2016, it was a different lesson where, you know, those who endorse, you know, essentially those who can signal the party's direction overwhelmingly signaled Hillary Clinton. And of course she gets the nomination, but you saw a really interesting challenge in Bernie Sanders, where he got almost no institutional party support. He got almost no endorsements in 2016. But nonetheless mounted a pretty serious challenge and stayed in the race and won a considerable number of delegates and won a considerable number of state contests and just sort of in some ways demonstrated in the same way that Donald Trump did that year how much personal agency candidates have, that, you know, even if the party doesn't want them, they can still stick around. You know, the party can't really force them to drop out of the race. And they can, you know, Sanders obviously didn't win the nomination that year, but he proved that he could stick around and he could deal some damage to the establishment and that they had to take him seriously. So, you know, I was going into this book thinking, well, what exactly does this mean for our understanding of nominations going forward? are Democrats essentially for 2020 in the same place that Republicans were in 2016? And if you were to go back to like 2018 or 2019, you could certainly see an argument for that, right? You had this huge, huge field of fairly high quality candidates, you know, lots of governors and senators and, you know, people with lots of credentials. But, you know, the party not necessarily unified in a direction. You know, they hadn't really, you know, as of early 2019, at least, they hadn't really rallied around anyone yet. And it looked like it could be a fairly split nomination contest. And you could see it unfolding for a lot of different candidates in a lot of different ways. So, you know, one could certainly, at least at that point, imagine a world in which you have a, you know, party establishment that is very split, can't figure out what it wants. Someone like Bernie Sanders essentially manages to get through and become the nominee through sheer force of will. Or, you know, another candidate just emerging, you know, someone like, say, you know, Pete Buttigieg, who was really very new on the scene, but was a good campaigner, was a good fundraiser, and, you know, could just manage to convince enough people that he should be the nominee, you know, without necessarily a lot of party backing. Yeah, you could, at least for a while, you could sort of imagine something like that happening. And that didn't happen at all. What we saw was something like the party making a decision that, you know, by the end of 2019, you know, the bulk of people I spoke to, the bulk of people who normally endorse candidates and others were backing Joe Biden. I do this other analysis in there where I look at the behavior of party donors, you know, those who both give to the Democratic Party and donate to presidential candidates. And by the end of 2019, they were overwhelmingly leaning Joe Biden. That is, you know, party money was going in his direction. And that was ultimately ratified in the primaries and caucuses. It didn't look that way early on. In February of 2020, of course, Joe Biden did very poorly in Iowa and New Hampshire. But by the time of South Carolina, by the time of Super Tuesday, pressure put on candidates by, you know, party elites, essentially, by, you know, those who make endorsements and those who give money, essentially forced other candidates out of the race. And or just, you know, made them see that they had no other path forward. And party very quickly coalesced around Joe Biden from that point on.
And so in that regard, you have the coalescing around Joe Biden as something that didn't seem inevitable. But as you note, a lot of indicators point in that direction. So I wanted to ask you this question, aside from, say, Donald Trump's nomination and so forth, what was surprising that you found as you were doing this research?
So one of the things that, you know, I don't know if surprising is quite the right word, but it was, that really stood out to me was how disoriented Democratic activists were about 2016. Just how much that election really shook them, not just politically, but like psychologically. A lot of them, use terms like trauma to describe their attitudes coming out of that election. That is, you know, essentially every indicator, every political instinct that they had, every indicator they knew to trust about how politics works, told them a certain thing was going to happen in 2016, and then the opposite happened. And it really kind of messed them up. And, I'm not saying that they, you know, they chose wrongly or that they, you know, they chose in a compromised state or anything like that, but they were looking for a way to not go through that again. To avoid the trauma of that experience. And I think, you know, part of it was being wrong. And I think part of it was, what Trump's presidency looked like after that, that they found it so, so aggressive and so odious. And they just, you know, they wanted to see, you know, figure out what they could do to avoid that happening again. But, you know, the, the degree to which a lot of activists just described the 2016 experience in very personal terms as something that really kind of messed them up and caused them to question a lot of key assumptions that they had about politics, really kind of stood out to me.
And I mean, I think that sort of questioning key assumptions about politics is also a lot of what's steering your research as you're going through this, in terms of trying to figure out, as you say, the analysis in, say, The Party Decides, or in Asymmetrical Politics, where we have an understanding of like how the parties work and what their dynamic is. And then we have the election of Donald Trump, who doesn't look like most nominees for the presidency or like a president that we've seen in the past. Obviously, that was his calling card, that he was, you know, different. And so I was wondering about a couple of the assumptions that you saw some of these activists talking about that they were really sort of shocked by, that didn't make sense to them at that point. I mean, as political scientists, we look at this from a variety of different places, but when you're talking about the activists, they're building on their own experience in politics.
Yeah. I had talked to, I remember I talked early on with a, you know, sort of a long-standing organizer in New Hampshire Democratic politics, who was repeating to me a lot of the, a lot of the folklore about, you know, how to win in the New Hampshire primary. You know, he says basically you have to, you know, if you want to really compete in the Democratic presidential primary in New Hampshire, you avoid the big speeches. You have to spend a lot of time essentially going to coffee shops, going to people's living rooms, you know, just meeting one-on-one, you know, having, you know, activists open doors for you, and no one's going to even consider you until you've shaken their hand four or five times and talked with them over for an hour. And then he mentions, oh, by the way, Donald Trump did none of that and he won anyway. And that messed them up, right? They were wondering if Trump's victory, in the Republican primary in New Hampshire and in some of these other contests meant that the old rules just didn't apply at all. That is, if they had, you know, if these activists had essentially no gatekeeping power whatsoever, and they really weren't the ones determining the nominee. And that was at least a fear I had in starting this book. And, you know, I was making this assumption that the, you know, party activists in these early contest states, that the decisions they make will turn out to be important and probably determinative of who the party nominates. But there was at least some chance that wasn't true, right? Coming out of 2016, there was some chance that essentially the party would decide on one thing and the voters would ultimately nominate someone completely different. Either way, I figured that would be an interesting story. But it was possible that my whole approach would completely crash and burn. I don't think it did.
I don't think it did.
Yeah. it was interested in seeing how that would unfold, because, you know, it's I love doing this research personally. Like, you know, I enjoyed spending a lot of time on the ground in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and Nevada and just getting a sense of these activists' own conception of this contest and what has to happen in it. And particularly in New Hampshire and Iowa, they have built up a whole infrastructure for understanding how their contest works. And there's a lot of folklore around it. And it's important to them that these contests matter. A lot of them are really enjoy this ritual of reporters and candidates and others, you know, kind of descending on their state and spending a lot of time there because they believe it matters. They believe that that outcome matters. You know, the fact that New Hampshire and Iowa, particularly, really didn't pick the nominee this time around is probably an important lesson. And I don't think we still have a full sense of what exactly that means. I think there were, important lessons that came out of that, but a lot of what was going on in the lead up to these early contests, you know, a lot of the discussions in late 2019 and early 2020 among the candidates, among political reporters and others, and that this was such a huge and diverse presidential field. You know, maybe the largely rural white voters of Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, maybe the decision they make would not be the one that would carry the day, that other parts of the party would also like a say in this. And in particular, you know, just sort of hanging over this was basically black voters in South Carolina, who, you know, a lot of South Carolina political leaders were saying for a long time, these folks need to weigh in. You know, black voters have an opinion here. They're a large, you know, this is like 20 to 25% of Democratic voters. They have some opinions here. And, you know, if we're thinking about identity, if we're thinking about the racial progress of this nation, these people really want a chance to weigh in. And, you know, so that, like, you know, whatever decision Iowa and New Hampshire make, it might not be enough. It might not be determinative. And you know, interestingly, there was always this suggestion that Biden was probably going to do well, you know, particularly among black voters in South Carolina. And he got a lot of the, you know, support from South Carolina's black political establishment, you know, especially from, you know, Representative Clymer and others. That ended up being a pretty important argument and pretty persuasive that, you know, that this segment of the party really could not be ignored. And particularly the fact that there were several very high quality black candidates in the race. You had Kamala Harris running for a long time. You had Cory Booker running for a long time and, you know, doing reasonably well, at least for a while, but never really winning a substantial portion of support among black Democratic voters in South Carolina or elsewhere who were largely sticking with Joe Biden. You know, that just suggested to a lot of other voters that, okay, there's some strength here, that, you know, going with Biden is not a complete abandonment of our, you know, this principle of egalitarianism that's really important to us, because, you know, this segment of the party, you know, black voters in within the Democratic Party seems comfortable with Biden. They seem to feel that he's someone they could work with and who cares about their interests, and that they, you know, that was an important part of the nomination.
So after this 4-year pursuit of understanding what the Democrats understood about 2016, what are you working on now, Seth?
I mean, I'm a little unsure at the moment. I think a lot of that...
You are disoriented.
Yeah. A lot of that will be determined by the outcome of the next election. If the current polling for the 2020 presidential election turns out to be roughly accurate, and Republicans lose, I would actually be fascinated to do a similar study of what happens among Republicans in the wake of a presidential loss. I can imagine there would be, you know, you can sort of imagine, you know, some of the fights within the party coming out of a presidential loss, where there were some voices within the Republican Party coming out of their 2012 loss. If you read that sort of that party's postmortem at the time, the GOP's the Growth and Opportunity Project, where, you know, some prominent members of the Republican National Committee were coming up with this report saying we lost because we alienated the immigrant communities. You know, we were too hard line on immigration. We seemed racist. We seemed sexist. We need to reach out to women. We need to reach out to people of color. And we need people to think we're open. You know, not just a party for older white men. And, you know, obviously, you know, the party ended up not going in that direction in 2016. But I imagine there are, you know, voices within the party that would say, hey, maybe we need to rethink that. And maybe, you know, go back to that solution and try not to alienate people, because, you know, 2016 was, you know, we didn't necessarily have to win 2016 by just a hair. And 2020, we didn't necessarily have to lose that either. You know, incumbent presidents rarely lose. That could have been managed better with a different president in power. So there'd be that. I would certainly be a prominent pro-Trump wing within the party that would basically be arguing that 2020 was a fluke. It was a pandemic that no one could see coming. And if not for that, you know, they would have won handily. Yeah, I think the evidence is not really very supportive of that, considering Biden was already leading by a healthy margin before the pandemic even hit. But that would be an argument that some would find persuasive. And I think, you know, even if he loses, Donald Trump will still be a pretty substantial voice within the Republican coalition, and he'll still have his Twitter account. And regardless of how much he were to lose by, he would be claiming that he was somehow screwed out of a second term because of, you know, some sort of voter fraud. So that, you know, there'd be that wing of the party. You could see this conversation unfolding and playing out over a lot of different ways. It would. If there's a way for me to do that and start talking to Republican activists in some of these early contest states, you know, that would be amazing. But you know, given the pandemic and other things, you know, how that research would unfold, I think would be a little different, but I'd be curious to take that on.
And you have the framework already of what you need to do, having done it once.
Yes. Yes. I mean, if I were to do nothing else but just, you know, repeat this style, I think I could have a pretty interesting story coming out of that. It's also possible, you know, they don't, that the party doesn't try to recalibrate. I mean, you know, Democrats, I think, are always more prone to just feeling like they did everything wrong and needing to completely, you know, completely revamp what they are as a party. And I think Republicans have generally been more resistant to that message. But you know, I think there's, you know, should they lose, I think there's a fascinating and probably pretty ugly fight, potentially brewing within that party that, you know, if possible, I would love to be able to listen in on that.
Well, if you end up writing that book, I hope you'll come and talk to me about it on the New Books Network once it's published.
I would love to do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today, Seth Maskett, author of Learning from Loss, The Democrats 2016 to 2020. This was published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. I assume you can purchase it at the Cambridge University Press website. Any other place you'd like to give a shout out to, Seth?
Yes, I would also mention that the Boulder Bookstore here in Colorado we had a nice book event for that last week, and I know they have copies in stock. They can be found at boulderbookstore.net.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was great to talk to you.